During the 20th century, there were major shifts in the incidence and types of disorders of the digestive tract, which account for 10% of all deaths in the United States. And the older you are, the higher the risk. 50% of the total number of prescriptions and 70% of the cost are medications for gastroesophageal reflux disease alone. Next in frequency come constipation, which causes hemorrhoids, diverticular disease, and then there's irritable bowel syndrome, which now affects up to 30% of women. So what's causing all this dysfunction? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello, I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. When it comes to digestive diseases, there are so many causes and factors to consider. So to help give us a basic understanding, here's dietitian Nia Shah from Stanford Digestive Health Center.
The process of digestion starts in the mouth. We have our teeth, we have our tongue, and we have our glands that produce saliva. Our teeth mechanically digest our food, mechanically breaks it down. Our tongue helps us move our food from our mouth into our esophagus. The saliva that we produce contains an enzyme called amylase, and that starts to break down the carbohydrates that come in from your diet. Once we swallow, the food travels through the esophagus and enters your stomach. The role of your stomach is to churn, to mix, and grind down our food. The stomach also produces an enzyme called pepsin to help us digest our protein, and it also produces hydrochloric acid that helps kill the bacteria that's coming in from our diet. Once it leaves the stomach, it enters the small intestine. That's the primary site for digestion and absorption. There are three segments of the small intestine: the duodenum, the jejunum, and the ileum. The duodenum is only about 10 inches long. This is where iron is absorbed. This is where pancreatic enzymes enter in. This is where bile from our gallbladder enters in. The whole process occurs along the entire small intestine, which is about a good 20 feet long. Since the duodenum is about 10 inches, the jejunum is about 6 to 8 feet long, and that's where most of our digestion absorption occur, along with the ileum, which is about 10 to 13 feet long. The remaining food that's not digested will enter from the small intestine into the colon, the large intestine. The colon's main role is to absorb water and electrolytes. And once that is completed, anything left behind is eliminated from our body.
And what's left behind will be some lovely fiber from the beans we'll show you how to cook on today's show. We also have an acclaimed author as a guest. But first, the news. In the headlines today, probiotics cut colic, dishwashing linked with more allergies, and breast milk effective for baby eczema. The preventive use of probiotics in newborns may reduce crying, vomiting, constipation, and healthcare-related costs. This Italian-based trial involved almost 600 newborn infants and assigned them to 3 months of either placebo or Lactobacillus reuteri. Compared with the placebo, those receiving the probiotics spent less time crying per day, vomited less often, and had more stools. They were seen by the pediatrician or an ER less often, were given fewer stomach-soothing products, and their parents missed fewer days of work. So probiotics appear to be cost-effective, healthier, and they keep babies, moms, and dads happier, with no side effects. Parents who wash the dishes by hand instead of using dishwasher are less likely to have children with allergies, according to a new Swedish study. The researchers are unable to say why, but wonder if the bacteria left on hand wash plates may teach the body to tolerate its environment better. They assessed eczema and asthma and found that washing dishes by hand was linked to a 43% reduced risk of allergies. Using fermented foods and buying directly from farms made the link even stronger, which fits with previous research that shows kids growing up on farms have fewer allergies. So while we can't all live on a farm, perhaps there are ways of bringing the farm to the table. For infants with atopic dermatitis, the topical application of human breast milk has the same efficacy as steroid ointment, according to a new study from Iran published in the International Journal of Dermatology. 100 babies attending a pediatric unit for mild to moderate atopic eczema were randomised to have 1% hydrocortisone ointment or mother's milk applied to their skin lesions twice a day. Researchers found no difference between the effectiveness of the two treatments. That's a convenient and affordable way to treat an irritating rash that affects up to 50% of babies. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's Health News. Today's interview was conducted at the American College of Lifestyle Medicine meeting in San Diego, where we spoke with integrative clinical nutritionist Kathy Swift. Kathy is the Education Director for Food as Medicine. Here she shares her personal story of why she has a strong focus on digestive health.
When I was living in the UK, and I had a number of different health issues, truly from head to toe, neurological symptoms, just many, many different things that were happening. And finally, after months of exploration with physicians, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition. So at that point, I asked not what, but why. And I began an exploration of what were some of the root causes that were contributing, that contributed to this diagnosis. And interestingly, all roads led through the gastrointestinal tract, which is why I affectionately dub it our highway to health or our pathway to pathology. And in my case, I later learned that, of course, 70% of our immune system resides in the gut. So not surprising that all these many different symptoms were relative to an autoimmune condition.
Now, most people think of the gut as being about digestion, excretion, but they don't think about that immune component. How is it that the immune system is so highly invested in the gastrointestinal tract?
Well, the immune system, when you think of it, our digestive tract is really more than this kind of sewer pipe, and it is a sensing. It has to sense the outside world that is coming within our body. So that's why our 70% of our immune system is there. It has a job to do. It has a number of different functions, and it interacts with our gut bacteria. It interacts with our barrier, a defense system in the gut, and also our nervous system. So there's this interplay of the immune system, the nervous system, the microbiota or small life that resides within us, and this barrier defense, all interacting to keep us well.
And we all want to stay well. More from Kathy in the next segment, but first, watch this. Oh, what happened?
Oh, I burned myself taking the radiator cap off.
Ooh, just a moment. Here.
What, a weed? I thought you're a real doctor.
I am a real doctor, but real doctors use herbs.
So what, do you have a crystal ball as well?
No. Did you know Thomas Edison once said, the doctor of the future will give no medicine?
Oh, really? Oh, wow, the burning is gone.
Great. Now we need to put on some aloe vera. And we'll cover that with a Band-Aid. There you go. Oh, that'll feel so much better.
Oh, I've never heard of using plantain for a burn. Why don't the drug companies use it?
Well, the average cost to get a drug to market is $1.3 billion by the time they do all the testing.
Wow, so there's no way that the drug companies could break even if they sold herbs.
That's right. I could pick it right out of the front yard. But herbs can treat some things that drugs can't.
Like what?
Like the pain of a mild burn with plantain and aloe vera. They do really well.
So if someone wants to learn about herbal remedies, they can read a book or go to a class or something like that?
They could. Or you could just go to a herbalist. And they've been trained in the benefits, the side effects, the dangers. the purity and the quality control of herbs. So consider your options. Doctor's orders. We're back. Now, the biggest step you can make in healthy cooking is to learn how to cook and use legumes. That means beans and lentils. Now, you probably realise they come out of the packet all dry, and it may seem like it's going to be really difficult to get them soft, cooked and tasty. Unless, of course, you cheat and open a can, which you can do, but it's more expensive, so you save a lot of money by knowing how to do this. There are basically three steps to cooking beans. You have to soak them first, then you cook them, and then you prepare them into a meal. So let's go through those steps. First of all, the soaking. You can take the little lentils or split peas. They don't actually require soaking because they're so small. But when it comes to garbanzos or the larger beans, you do need to soak them. So you can significantly speed up soaking time too. So let me give you a trick. If you're soaking beans, you need to put about 2.5 cups of water to 1 cup of dry beans because they're going to expand at least 2 times, maybe 3 times. So put them in the vessel that you're going to cook them in, pour in the water, and then leave them to sit overnight or for 6 to 8 hours during the day. If you don't have that time because you forgot, what you can do is put them into a pot, bring them to the boil, turn it off, leave it to soak for 1 hour, and then they'll be ready to go through their cooking time. Okay, so that would be the equivalent of a soak. You want to, once you've soaked them, throw away your soak water. You need new water for cooking because there's some toxins in that water, so you need to discard it. Also, you'd get more gas. We know that beans, if you're not used to eating beans, you will get gas. Once your gut has got used to eating beans all the time, you're not going to get the gas problem. But if you do have a real problem with gas, then you can actually soak them, pour off the water, freeze them, and then thaw them out when you're ready, and that will help with the gas. Now, that's the soaking. Let's look at what you do to cook them. You can use a slow cooker. This is really simple, easy. You just put your beans that have been soaked and drained into your slow cooker, and you fill it up with water a little bit higher than the level of your beans, and then you cook it on low. So you just turn it to low for 6 hours. If you're going to be home, you're going to be able to turn it off, you're not sleeping, you can do it on high for 4 hours. But if you're going to do that, be sure that you don't lose too much water, because if it dries out, you're going to have a really hard time getting your crock clean again. Now, don't add the salt before it's cooked, because salt will toughen the skins and it will seem like you can never get it soft. You'll think that you haven't cooked it yet, you've boiled it for hours. Now, when you do put salt in at the end, it's about 1/2 to 3/4 of a teaspoon for every cup of dry legumes. And you can put them in near the end of the cooking time after the beans have got soft. And that goes for if you cook them in a pressure cooker as well. With a pressure cooker, you've soaked and drained your beans, you've put them in the pressure cooker, and then you just have the water at the same level as your legumes, because they're going to cook really fast. Now, when I'm cooking beans, whatever method, I'll always like to add some bay leaves. Bay leaves give it that a really nice savory flavor. So put your bay leaves in with your beans, with that water, put your pressure cooker on. Once you get up to pressure, then you're going to keep it there for 12 to 20 minutes, depending on the size of your legume. So if you've got the smaller split pea, it's only going to be about 12 minutes. If you've got a chickpea, and especially a large chickpea, you might even do it for 25 minutes. So that's really quick and easy, and that's the way I always choose to do it. And again, salt after it comes out of the pressure cooker. For a saucepan, what we need for a saucepan is to, again, put the soaked, drained beans in, bring it to the boil with fresh water, and then once it's to the boil, lower the temperature and simmer it for 60 to 90 minutes, again, depending on the size of your beans. You can check the package to see how long you need to cook them. But also, just check your beans occasionally, because sometimes they'll cook more quickly than the package says. So that's a really quick. Now, once you've cooked them, they're still going to be rather bland. So what I would recommend is that you think about how to flavour them. Some of my favourite ways to flavour them are to use some, perhaps some sun-dried tomatoes, some seasoning mix. I get into all my herbs and I have a great time with herbs. Probably my favourite one for legumes is thyme and occasionally sage. I also like to fry onion, add cumin, maybe cumin, turmeric, coriander. Those are my favourites. And fry them up, perhaps add a little bit of coconut milk and some, perhaps some pasta sauce, and you've got a lovely, lovely dish. So once you've cooked them though and they're just plain, you can just throw them in the freezer. They'll keep frozen for up to 6 months. In the fridge, they'll keep for 6 days. So give it a go. You'll find it's quick, it's easy, and it will make vegetarian food cooking a breeze. NutritionFacts.org is a public service provided by nutrition researcher Dr. Michael Greger. Here he talks about the power of probiotics.
Babies delivered via cesarean section appear to be at increased risk for various allergic diseases. The thought is that vaginal delivery leads to the first colonization of the gut with maternal vaginal bacteria, while C-section babies are deprived of this natural exposure and exhibit a different gut flora. This is supported by research noting that a disturbance in maternal vaginal flora during pregnancy may be associated with early asthma in their children. This all suggests our natural gut flora can affect the development of our immune system, for better or for worse. In adulthood, two studies published back in 2001 suggested that probiotics could have systemic immunity-enhancing effects. Subjects were given a probiotic regimen between weeks 3 to 6 and saw a significant boost in the ability of their white blood cells to chomp down on potential invaders. And what's interesting is that even after the probiotics were stopped, there was still enhanced immune function a few weeks later compared to baseline. The same boost was found in the ability of their natural killer cells to kill cancer cells. And similar results were also found using a different probiotic strain. Now, improving immune cell function in a petri dish is nice, but does this actually translate into people having fewer infections? For that, we had to wait another 10 years, but now we have randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled studies showing that those taking probiotics may have significantly fewer colds, fewer sick days, and fewer symptoms. The latest review of the best studies to date found that probiotics, such as those in yogurt, soy yogurt, or supplements, may indeed reduce one's risk of upper respiratory tract infection, but the totality of evidence is still considered weak, so it's probably too early to make a blanket recommendation. Unless one has suffered a major disruption of gut flora by antibiotics or an intestinal infection, unless one is symptomatic with like diarrhea or bloating, I would suggest focusing on feeding the good bacteria we already have by eating so-called prebiotics such as fiber. After all, as we saw before, who knows what you're getting when you buy probiotics? They may not even be alive by the time you buy them, and they also have to survive the journey down to the large intestines. Altogether, these points suggest that the advantages of prebiotics found in plant foods outweigh those of probiotics. And by eating raw fruits and vegetables, we may be getting both. Fruits and vegetables are covered with millions of lactic acid bacteria, some of which are the same type used as probiotics. So when studies show eating more fruits and vegetables boosts immunity, prebiotics and probiotics may both be playing a role.
So be sure to get both. Here's integrative clinical nutritionist Kathy Swift to tell us about the root causes of digestive issues.
Well, there are many, and to begin with, are how we begin life. Children that are babies that are born via C-section, they're set up for allergies and other conditions later in life. So better that a baby be born that gets the inoculation of the mom through the vaginal birth canal.
Right, it's because babies born with a sterile gastrointestinal, that none of those microbiota are there yet. So it kind of inherits that at that point. And what you're bringing out, as an OBGYN, you know, I realize this is so important for setting a baby up for good health right at the start.
Absolutely, because instead they're inheriting the environment of the hospital and such. So, so that's not something we can change, but there are many things that we can change. And with respect to infants also, breast milk, breastfeeding is ideal because there's growth factors and components in breast milk that are important for the microbiota. It's the right nourishment. But what the other things are that are contributing, medications, antibiotics, antacids, anti-inflammatories, use of so many of these that is causing the gut to be more leaky, which sets us up for problems.
So that's that defense system that's coming in. So the nutrients that normally, or the food particles or the molecules of nutrients would normally go through and it's sealed, you're saying they can leak through that wall?
Yes.
And penetrate the body?
Right, and can set the person up for a host of different problems, yes. So some other things that contribute are supersized stress. It's fascinating the work on with respect to how stress impacts our gastrointestinal health, again causing the gut to become more porous and undigested food and pathogens that can seep through and cause problems, just so influencing neurotransmitters, chemicals that we produce, things like our feel-good chemical serotonin or our calming GABA, those are all altered because of stress, and that's certainly something that we can work on, you know, with lifestyle measures. And they're even looking at sleep deprivation and its impact on gastrointestinal health. So many root causes that we can change with changes in our lifestyle.
And I guess that makes sense because if our nervous system is heavily invested in the gut, and sleep is all to do with the brain, isn't it? Then
Yes. You've
got this very strong interplay.
Yes.
Now, how is the gut and the microbiome connected to cognitive health, or is it?
It definitely is. In fact, one of the most interesting areas, I think, of research right now is what's been called the microbiota brain-gut axis. The fact that our mood, our memory, our emotional resiliency is connected to our digestive health versus this wandering network, the vagus nerve. So the brain in our belly is communicating to our brain in the head and likewise. So there's this communication and it's really fascinating. In fact, there's been articles published with titles like Melancholic Microbes and looking at how that our brains, our two brains are so intimately connected.
So you're suggesting we can improve mood by dealing with by altering the microbes in our gut.
We can. It's very, very good news that this connection, and we can alter it by changes in our lifestyle that help with our stress and diet. Diet can manipulate the entire gastrointestinal milieu. It's wonderful.
So there's hope.
Oh.
And you're talking about mood changes, anxiety, depression.
Mm-hmm. Yes, anxiety, depression. And there's been articles that have certainly revealed some of the mechanisms, and that anxiety and depression in our brain, no, in our gut.
You mentioned your own story about mm-hmm. autoimmune disease. So, is there a strong relationship between autoimmune diseases and what's happening in someone's gut? Like, if someone is diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, should they go to someone like yourself to actually have their gastrointestinal tract checked?
Yeah. There's absolutely a strong connection between the autoimmune epidemic and the gut. And again, because most of our immune system resides here. So whether, and I've worked with patients with scleroderma, with lupus, with rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, and we always begin with a digestive health program. And it's hopeful, and it's wonderful to see what we can do to strengthen the immune system and restore health.
So by caring for our intestinal health, we care for our immune system. I'll be back with a demo after the break, but first, this. In Matthew 4:4, Jesus likened hearing God's voice to eating. He had just ended a 40-day fast when he had a visit from Satan, tempting him to abuse God's power and perform a miracle by turning rocks into bread. Jesus learned self-control in the desert, and we need to learn it too, not just for physical health, but for emotional intelligence and spiritual success. To Satan, Jesus said, "Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God," indicating that a relationship with God is more important than our relationship with food. With it, we thrive. Without it, we don't survive. While I'm not advocating a 40-day fast, many of us think we can't go 4 hours without eating. So I'd encourage you to consider a short fast, maybe 2 or 3 meals, combined with time alone with God, just like Jesus did. Your digestion will rest and recover while you nurture your spiritual self. When we're born, we have a sterile gut. It's just us and the epithelium that lines our gut, all the single cell layer. But you know, within a few hours, bacteria begin to set up home. Now we need these bacteria for good immune function, nutrient breakdown, metabolism, and to create a healthy intestinal barrier. Now, if we're born by cesarean section, or if we're fed baby formula, the microbes that populate our gut are different and fewer in number than those that we might have following a normal birth, or if we're fed mother's milk, because those processes are not sterile, and so we get those bacteria from our mums. Pretty soon, the human intestine is a huge, complex ecosystem where 1,000 different species of microorganisms in vast numbers outnumber our host cells by a factor of 10 to 100. Our own cells, the food that we eat, and the quadrillion bacteria that ride around with us all interact with one another. Plus, these living organisms all have their own DNA or genetic code, known as the microbiome, and collectively, it's 100 times larger than our own genome. So it's really important which bugs we have. Right from birth, we want lots of these bifidobacteria. Now you can see these bifidobacteria are actually a marker of good intestinal health. And it's amazing, God has put into mother's milk the food that these bacteria need. We know that low levels predispose to more asthma, eczema, and allergies as a child. And later, if we don't have enough, we get inflammatory bowel disease, obesity, diabetes, autism, depression, and anxiety. So these are really important little fellas. At any age, multiple courses of antibiotics within a 6-month period can significantly alter gut microbiota, and that's when we would need to take extra of the lactobacillus and the bifidobacterium. Now, our understanding of this rapidly expanding field is still limited, but what we do know is that each of us is unique and different from one another. The number and distribution of these bacterial species is similar amongst healthy individuals. Now,
If we have an abnormal kind of gut flora, we call it dysbiosis, and that can result in a break in the lining of the gut. And what happens is the bacteria and the food pass right through, right into our bodies, and that challenges our immune system, setting us up for food allergies, food sensitivities, and autoimmune disease. Now, there's a lot of interest in altering the gut microbiota to prevent or even treat disease. And one way to do that is to actually eat bifidobacteria or lactobacillus by taking them as yogurt or kefir or sauerkraut, because those foods contain colonies of these particular bacteria. Or we can actually take them as supplements, just in capsule, as powder, and add them to our diet. The other way we can do that is to selectively stimulate the growth and the activity of these friendly gut bacteria microbes that we already have, getting them to multiply so that they can confer those health benefits to us. And the foods that do that are called prebiotics. They're really just food for these particular bacteria. And by doing that, we'll increase calcium absorption, our energy, satiety, so we feel nice and full after a meal. That will help to normalize weight. It will also improve gut function and reduce the risk of colon cancer. Now, prebiotics are short-chain carbohydrates. We'll have this to represent it. And what they do is they can't be broken down by us, but the bacteria can break them down into short-chain fatty acids, plus hydrogen and carbon dioxide gas, which, once your body's used to them, they don't notice the gas so much, that it's not so much a problem. And these short-chain fatty acids feed the lining of our gut so that we can heal and repair and maintain good health. So where do we find these prebiotics? Here they are: wheat, pistachio nuts, apples, bananas, kiwi fruit. And if we're thinking about vegetables, then artichokes, onions, garlic and leeks, the allium family, and then also in legumes, so chickpeas, lentils and beans. Now you'll notice that all these foods have something in common. They all come from the plant kingdom.
Are midnight raids on the refrigerator spoiling your healthy eating plans? Three recent studies found a delicious way to control your hunger cravings: eating more whole grains. The studies all showed that people who eat more whole grains actually eat less because they feel fuller with less food. Regularly enjoying oatmeal, quinoa, and other whole grains will make you feel full more quickly, and it will keep the hunger pangs away. Adding whole grains to your daily diet is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time for you to ask the questions. Marianne asks, I'm slowly losing weight, which is good, but I'm realizing a lot of food seems to bloat me, like cornflakes with milk and sugar or tea and bread. I also have adrenal ulcer and I get heartburn with sweet potatoes, which is eased when I avoid starches. What can I do? Well, it sounds like you have a full house. Bloating, ulcer, gastroesophageal reflux. So your digestion is really struggling. One thing I'm just a little bit suspicious of with this story is that you may have an intolerance to dairy. So I would suggest eliminating it from your diet. That will include all forms of milk, butter, cheese, yogurt, sour cream, cream cheese, even chocolate. What you need to do is read the ingredients on all the things that you buy that's pre-made in the store, and be sure that it doesn't contain any whey, lactose, any other dairy hiding in there. Do that for a month and then see how you feel. The other thing is, as you're pointing out, a lot of carbohydrate all at once seems to overwhelm your digestive tract. So it's not good to eat a lot of carbohydrates all at once, which you're describing there. So what you might want to do is start your meal with either a fruit salad or a big green salad, and then move on to the cooked food and try to have some variety. I recommend that you give your gut a rest one day a week. If you're not diabetic, this should be fine for you, by skipping either one, two, or three meals in a day. Don't drink with your meals, because that will dilute the digestive juices and rush the food through the stomach. So try those things, see how you go. Joanne called from Texas. I'm lactose intolerant and I enjoyed your soy yogurt recipe, but people are telling me that soy is not good because it contains phytates that block calcium absorption and soy causes birth defects.
I use the yogurt for protein and probiotics. I want to know more. Well, I would warn you that the meat and the dairy industries are both powerful and they create a lot of controversy over soy because soy is commonly used to replace meat and dairy in the diet. So, unfortunately, we can't believe everything we read. It is true that there are phytates in soy, but they're also in nuts, all other legumes and grains. So just picking on soy is a little unfair. By the way, phytates are actually antioxidants. They bind certain minerals like iron, zinc, manganese, and less commonly calcium. And what that does is it slows the absorption of the minerals, but there's no scientific evidence that this has ever caused a deficiency in any humans. If you're eating a well-balanced diet, caring for your gut to optimize absorption, then the small amounts that will bind to phytates won't be an issue overall. Just don't eat a lot of wheat bran because that has extra phytate. Do that and you should be fine. By the way, phytates are antioxidants, they're anti-inflammatories, and so on balance, they actually convey a health advantage. Got a text from Rose. I'm entering menopause. My mum has osteoporosis, so I'm taking calcium, magnesium, and multivitamins. Is it okay to crush them for easier absorption or swallowing to avoid sitting in my stomach lining? Well, you want to check with the manufacturer. Whenever you're taking a supplement or a medication, always check that it's okay to crush it because it depends on the formulation and the coating of what you're taking. Be careful, though, about supplementing calcium because recently it has been linked to an increased risk of heart disease. So you should consult your doctor or a nutritionist to find out if you are taking a safe amount. Those were great questions. Remember, you can phone, email, text or Facebook anytime. Now let's go shopping. Lemons are the most commonly used citrus. They're native to Asia, but they've migrated all over the world. We use their juice and their zest more than we use their pulp, so look for smooth, brightly coloured skin. And if the fruit feels heavy for its size, then it should be nice and juicy. The juice is useful to preserve foods that oxidise and discolour quickly, like apples, bananas or avocados. Once squeezed, there's a quick loss of vitamin C, so be sure to drink your lemonade right away. Recent animal research suggests that citrus have anti-cancer properties. Also, if you want to alkalinize your body in the mornings, then squeeze fresh lemon juice into your morning water. But be careful, it will erode the enamel on your teeth. So you better use a straw. Bon appetit. Our guest today is Kathy Swift, nutritionist and author of several books. Here she explains the symptoms that can reflect a gastrointestinal disorder.
They may be aware that they have a number of digestive symptoms. It may be bloating, it may be abdominal pain, it can be changes in elimination, constipation, diarrhea, or alternating. So there can be, of course, digestive symptoms, and there can be other symptoms too. So I use a number of really questionnaires. So a person self-observing, you know, can often will come up with a list of various complaints that are related to digestive dysfunction.
Mm-hmm. And then when you assess them, how do you start your assessment?
In dialogue, but actually what I do is food journal. Food journal, very, very important, and not just about food, but also with symptoms, with elimination patterns, with mood and emotional information, along with, I have a 20-page questionnaire that explores everything from early life history to current medications, supplements, so many different family history. So it's really a journey into past and present with symptomatology, with dietary data. So it's putting together what we might call an instrument panel of their health history so we can tailor what might be the best intervention for this person.
In your book, you have a 5-step program for improving gut function. Walk us through that.
The 5-step program begins with, I refer to it as MENS, and the M stands for minding your digestion. So the integration of mindful eating practices into one's life. Very, very important, because digestion begins in the head. It's from the Greek word meaning cephalic. So how we eat, and when we eat, all of these things are very, very important in restoring the resiliency of the gut.
Explain the mindfulness part of the eating.
By mindfulness, what I mean is that when we're eating food, we are truly present with our food. We are eating slowly, we're chewing our food, we're really making the connection, and because it can be very, very helpful.
Mm. Yes, many people, they sit and watch TV and it just goes in. They're not even aware that they're consuming all these calories. And that's mindless eating.
So mindless, yes.
So thank you for that explanation. Yeah. Now, moving on then to the E of the men's.
Yes, the E is eliminate. There are some components in our diet that may be aggravating the immune system in the gut, the nervous system in the gut. It can be things like gluten found in grain, various grain products, wheat, rye, barley. It can be different components of dairy products, perhaps. So also there's some types of carbohydrates that can be aggravating. These are what we refer to as the FODMAP gang. So it's removing these components, and then the N is nourishing, bringing in the things that support digestive health, an eating plan that is tailored to support digestive health. And the other component of it is the D stands for dietary supplements. There are a number of natural agents that can help heal the digestive tract. It may be using something like enteric-coated peppermint capsules for an irritable bowel. It may be using a probiotic to help reestablish good flora in the gut. So there's a number of digestive aids that can be useful.
Which a common question my viewers ask is, which probiotic should they use? Do you have any guidance there? Or?
Yes, I do outline various probiotics in the book, and it really depends, and it can entail some experimentation to find the right microbial match, so to speak, for the person based on their symptomatology. For example, if someone has even inflammatory bowel, we may use something like VSL3. Someone has a different type of condition, we may use a different probiotic with a lactobacillus formula, or perhaps even a Saccharomyces boulardii. So it really depends, and finding that right match may require a little bit of experimentation. And another thing, of course, is the introduction perhaps of some fermented foods. These are foods that have active cultures that interact with our resident gut bacteria. So for some people, it may be the just inclusion of fermented foods. They may not need a probiotic capsule or powder or such. So
what about
always try to do it with food first.
Right, that holistic kind of approach. What about digestive enzymes? What's the role for digestive enzymes or betaine hydrochloride?
Yes, well, they can be very helpful. Digestive enzymes actually help break down food into smaller components. For example, proteases can help break down proteins, and we may be most familiar with a lactase enzyme that helps digest the lactose, the prominent sugar in milk products and such. So in my, arsenal, so to speak, of dietary supplements, I will say that I do use digestive enzymes quite often, and sometimes hydrochloric acid also, yeah.
Stay with us. We're back with more right after the break. We're back. Our bodies have an internal clock that controls things such as hormones and sleep. Did you know our intestines have a cycle as well? And regularity is really important. That's eating regularly and eliminating regularly to help that cycle. And if I say prunes, you're probably thinking about regularity in a different context. Here's another clip from nutritionfacts.org.
Though there is an International Prune Association keeping us all apprised of the latest prune news from around the world, in the U.S., the California Prune Board successfully pressured the FDA to change the name from prunes to dried plums, which evidently evokes more of a positive fresh fruit goodness image, in hopes of attracting their target audience, women. Of course, it might help if they actually included one or two on their board. The name change is in hopes of de-emphasizing its connections to digestive regularity issues. But hey, why sell yourself short? Check this out. Randomized clinical trial, prunes versus Metamucil, also known as psyllium. Constipation is a common problem. It affects up to a fifth of the world's population. Nearly 60 million Americans suffer from chronic constipation, particularly a problem in women, the elderly. A pathological condition that is often severe enough to disrupt daily activities, a deranged quality of life, and responds poorly to available medical remedies, and may prompt sophisticated, potentially harmful surgical procedures. You know, despite all this, it's still frequently considered a trivial issue, and affected individuals tend to self-medicate, either using over-the-counter laxatives or quote-unquote natural remedies, but none of these have been adequately investigated until now. Fiber supplements can be inconvenient, taste nasty, cause bloating, even choking. So we need a food-based, natural, convenient, tasty alternative. But do prunes actually work? Here's the study subjects at baseline. Each dot is a complete spontaneous bowel movement. Note how many people had zero bowel movements per week at baseline. About an average of 1.7 a week, which went up to 3.5 on prunes, a bowel movement every other day or so, then back to baseline off of the prunes, then on Metamucil got up to 2.8, then back down. And remember the Bristol stool scale? Significantly better stool consistency on the prunes as well. The researchers conclude that treatment with dried plums resulted in a greater improvement in constipation symptoms than the commonly used fiber supplements. So, given their palatability, tolerability, availability, dried plums should be considered as a kind of first-line therapy for chronic constipation. If this is what adding one plant can do, 3.5 bowel movements a week, what if all you ate was plants? Where do vegans rate? Going, going, gone. Not two, not three, but 10.9 a week.
Sounds like a lot, but it's only once or twice a day. Today we're talking with nutritionist Kathy Swift about the five-step program to good digestive health that she outlines in her book, The Swift Diet. MENS stands for mindfulness, eliminate the problem foods and eat nutritious foods, if needed take dietary supplements, and the S stands for sustaining practices like meditation, sleep, and regularity. I asked her why sleep is important for healthy digestion.
Sleep is crucial. We live in a sleep-deprived society, yes, and as we learn more about the interplay of circadian rhythms and digestive secretions and gut hormones, I think it bids all of us well to get a minimum of 6 to 8 hours of sleep. They're uncovering that there's clock genes in the gut and such, so I think it's a topic we're going to hear more about in with respect to digestive health.
Mm, because I think there's an interplay with the microbiome as well as with the brain, of course, the nervous system. So that
right.
Must be powerful. What about the regularity in eating? You know, the circadian rhythm, trying to be up at the same time and have your meals at similar times each day. Is that important?
I think it's very important, and I think we've become misaligned with nature and nature's rhythms, and so to reestablish that can be helpful. We're learning about something called the migrating motor complex, or what's often referred to as the cleansing wave of the gut. So integrating what I refer to as some sacred space between meals allows for this cleansing wave that may help keep unfriendly bacteria from moving up and harboring in the intestinal tract.
There are some gut irritants that people really need to be aware of. Mm-hmm. And you talk about those. What are they? Just run through them and why it's important to eliminate them.
Okay. Well, there's a number of, and it varies with each person, of course, but it may be things like alcohol. Alcohol in some individuals may, depending on the amount that they consume, can increase the porousness, the leakiness, the permeability of the gut, which sets the stage for trouble. It may be in another individual, it may be their caffeine intake could be problematic. For many individuals, it's the tsunami of sugar. And also even artificial sweeteners. We're learning more about how they may impact the gut and interact, sending the wrong messages to the microbiota. So those are some of the other dietary factors that come into play.
What about dairy? Is dairy a problem? Many people seem to be lactose intolerant or dairy intolerant.
They do, yes. In fact, dairy is recognized, at least in North American research, as one of the top 8 allergens. But also many people have an intolerance to some of the components in dairy, particularly the lactose, one of the primary carbohydrates in dairy.
And so, and thinking of intolerance, wheat or gluten intolerance, what percent of the population is, in your estimate, is affected by a gluten sensitivity?
Oh, wow. Yeah, the numbers vary depending on the articles, but some say perhaps as high as 30% of the population. This is different from celiac disease, where, of course, the villi are destroyed, but gluten sensitivity may impact many, many, many individuals.
If a baby's born by C-section, mm-hmm. or they've had antibiotics, or say mum's had antibiotics in that early period and they're breastfeeding, so the bubs is getting antibiotics as well, is it good to give them a probiotic once the antibiotics are finished? Or?
Yes, I think it's an excellent idea, a wonderful strategy. In fact, there's research that indicates even on the last few weeks of a woman's pregnancy, they may want to start on a probiotic, and we may see a decrease in problems down the road. So my own daughter, we had her on a probiotic in her last month of pregnancy, and I think, you know, fortunately the children were born natural.
Didn't use the sunroof? No.
Right.
And what probiotic would you use, say, for a pregnant woman?
I would use what's called a broad spectrum probiotic that has a number of different species that have been best studied. Usually these are a combination of lactobacillus and a bifidobacteria, and I often look for a little bit more bifidobacteria. So there's a number of companies that do have formulas with these best researched and studied species.
And how many million, what strength are you, should people look at? Because there's so many out there.
There are.
There are some that I think people are wasting their money. They're just not strong enough. So is there a limit that above which you say, well, if it's above this, then it's worth buying?
I'd like to say we know, but I think I don't think we're at that stage yet. I think, I've talked with many, many researchers in this field. There's been probiotic symposiums and such, and to say exactly that it's 1 billion, 5 billion, 100 billion, or 450 billion, I think it's we're still at a point in time where we don't have that exact answer. So I think a formula, some of the formulas that have a broad spectrum have maybe 25 billion colony forming units in it, somewhere 25 to 100 billion, somewhere in that ballpark.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. We've run out of time.
Thank you.
Take care to eat and drink what will do you good and not harm. Remember to include prebiotics and probiotics in your diet. Pause to express gratitude before every meal, being mindful of its blessings. Be regular with your meal times, leaving adequate time between meals for your digestion to accomplish its needs. Go to bed with an empty stomach as close to the same time every night, and don't skimp on sleep. In her lecture, Kathy shared that of all the bodily functions, digestion is the one that exercises the greatest influence on the mental state of an individual. Are you ready to give it your best? Thanks for watching Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.